of a political settlement. At the same time, he stressed that Moscow should not underestimate the cohesion and determination of Germany's NATO allies.
As for the situation with the negotiations, the positions differ, but it's important that we talk to each other. The proposals that were formulated by Russia, we also do not agree with them. NATO and the EU do not agree, but they also contain points that we are ready to talk about and are ready to discuss. Now it is necessary that a dangerous situation does not arise.
The German Chancellor noted that positions of the West and Russia on security guarantees diverge, but the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO is not on the agenda. This is while statements that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine continue to come from the West, an allegation vehemently denied by Moscow.
Germany, as an important member of NATO, could influence its partners in the bloc, who, judging by their actions, are set up for a conflict with Russia. Moscow is not satisfied with semitones and ambiguities in matters of security guarantees. Their clear fixation is necessary. Only thanks to this it is possible to achieve a diffusion of tension, which is in the interests of Germany, located in the center of Europe. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiyah as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip.
Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complain about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since been clamping down on any sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty. Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
The Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al-Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is a proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power, on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Liz Truss has gone from political also-ran to holding one of the highest offices of state in the UK, the country's representative to the globe. Promoted by Boris Johnson from International Trade Secretary to Foreign Secretary, with the additional job of solving the Brexit standoff with the EU, as well as pushing through with the talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA, Truss has only been an MP since 2010. Whilst her in-tray may be overflowing, reports reveal the behind-the-scenes briefing Truss has had, this to gauge support as she fights a silent battle with Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's seen by many as her main rival for the Prime Minister's position should Johnson quit or be ousted. Truss's shift from staunch Remainer to ardent Brexiteer via a Margaret Thatcher-style makeover has not convinced everyone of her Iron Lady credentials.
I think Liz Truss is regarded by a lot of backbenchers as being quite lightweight. I think there's possibly a bit of sexism in that, but although the Conservative Party has had two women leaders, unlike Labour, I think we've also seen Liz Truss last week in Moscow really banging the war drums, trying to show how tough she was in regards to the whole Ukraine-Russia question. And I think part of that was to please Tory backbenchers.
It's a short walk from the Foreign Office to Downing Street, a fact that would not be lost on Liz Truss and her advisers. It's also a short political step from one of the senior offices of state to the top job. Just ask Boris Johnson, who was Foreign Secretary, before replacing Theresa May as Prime Minister. For a politician with such an important diplomatic brief, scandal has followed Truss with question marks about her judgment. Highlights or lowlifes include racking up thousands on expenses whilst on a three-day trip to Japan, claims of cronyism and using the expensive members-only club owned by a Tory donor during her stint as trade minister.
It doesn't seem to be held against anyone in the Conservative Party. We've seen lots of this around the test and trace thing at the beginning of the pandemic. We've seen Boris Johnson's flat. We've seen all sorts of stuff around this, and it doesn't seem to ever come back in anyone. So I don't think that's going to bother most Conservative MPs and most Conservative members.
It seems Liz Truss's major selling point is not her intellectual gravitas or political track record. In fact, the opposition points out she did not actually finalise a single new deal that the UK did not have with the EU as trade minister, but rather she's the anti-Sunak, a flip-flopping ideologue who is not an ethnic minority. For some Conservatives, that may just be enough. Amina Taylor, London.
Millions of US dollars have been approved recently by the Israeli regime as part of a plan to connect illegal settlements in occupied East Al-Quds with those built in West the Holy City. This was revealed by Israeli media days after the regime's foreign minister Yair Lapid stated that Israel won't build a new settlement that will impede a future two-state solution, but only settler homes will be built in existing settlements across the occupied territories. Settlement watchdog groups said such statements are meant to deceive the world as settlement activity goes on behind the scenes.
What Slabid is saying is just like playing with the words, you know, but it's so clear and obvious that what's happening in Jerusalem is an ethnic cleansing that's going on and Judaizing the city itself. You know, when they are talking about linking the settlements and the outposts in and around Jerusalem with real way to connect it with West Jerusalem, just to make it a surrounding of West Jerusalem, and dumping the whole Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem.
Israel's Finance Committee has approved a plan worth $310 million in order to link settlements in West Al-Quds with the other settlements in East Al-Quds, where the majority of its residents are Palestinians. The plan also includes expansion of the light rail, roads, and infrastructure construction that would be only serving the settlers. Palestinians say this plan will further undermine the feasibility of East Al-Quds as the capital of the future state. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population in the Holy City and in Area C that constitutes about 60% of the occupied West Bank. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Observers say that Israel is moving ahead with settlement construction and is erecting new roads to only serve settlers, while at the same time, the occupying regime is squeezing Palestinians out of their land, their ancestors' land, to make their dream of an independent state impossible. Mona Kandil, in front of the illegal settlement of Pesigot, occupied Ramallah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
We have made many achievements to this day, thanks to movement in the direction of the revolution. However, there is a long way till we reach those goals. Of course, we can attain them, provided that the train continues to move down the same railway, the same direction that Imam Rahmatullah Ali moved the train of the Islamic community. After Imam's demise, whenever we acted in a revolutionary manner, we managed to move forward. And whenever we ignored the revolutionary behavior and jihadi movement, we fell behind. We were frustrated. This was the reality. I myself was an official during those years. If there have been some flaws, this humble person is partly to blame. Whenever we preserved our revolutionary outlook, whenever we moved in a jihadi manner, and whenever we moved along the special track, we managed to move forward. On the other hand, whenever we showed negligence, we fell behind. We can catch up if we move forward in a revolutionary manner.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This message is being addressed with today's generation and to all future generations. This message is being addressed with all of us. Officials and the political, cultural and social activists are all the addressees of this statement. The youth, academic and seminarians and seminarian personalities, business people, villagers and city dwellers are all addressees of this statement. Everyone should know that this path can be taken with a revolutionary approach. And only then will progress be definite. Or we can move in a different direction. And then a dreadful fate will befall us. Imam Rahmatullah Alayh had a well-known statement he shared. He used to say, if this happens, it will be a slap in the face to Islam. If we change the path, the people of Iran will be slapped across the face and so will Islam. There are many necessary things to say in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
It has not been uncommon in recent years to hear Americans worry about the advent of a new civil war. Is civil war ahead? The New Yorker asked last month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Jamel Bowie. The piece is titled, Why We Are Not Facing the Prospect of a Second Civil War, and has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. Stay with us for more. It has not been uncommon in recent years to hear Americans worry about the advent of a new civil war. Is civil war ahead? The New Yorker asked last month. Is America heading to civil war or secession? CNN wondered on the anniversary of the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. Last week, Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois told The View that we have to recognize the possibility of a civil war. I don't think it's too far of a bridge to think that's a possibility, he said. This isn't just the media or the political class, it's public opinion as well. In a 2019 survey for the Georgetown Institute of Politics, the average respondent said that the United States was two-thirds of the way towards the edge of a civil war. In a recent opinion poll conducted by the Institute of Politics at Harvard University, 35% of voting-age Americans under the age of 30 placed the odds of a second civil war at 50% or higher. And in a result that says something about the divisions at hand, 52% of Donald Trump voters and 41% of Joe Biden voters said that they at least somewhat agree that it's time to split the country, with either red or blue states leaving the Union and forming their own country, according to a survey conducted by the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, where I am a visiting scholar. Several related forces are fueling this anxiety, from deepening partisan polarization and our winner-take-all politics to our sharp division across lines of identity, culture and geography. There is the fact that this country is saturated with guns, as well as the reality that many Americans fear demographic change to the point that they're willing to do pretty much anything to stop it. There is also the issue of Donald Trump, his strongest supporters and their effort to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Americans feel farther apart than at any point in recent memory, and as a result, many Americans fear the prospect of organized political violence well beyond what we saw on 6th of January 2021. There is, however, a serious problem with this narrative. The civil war we fought in the 19th century was not sparked by division qua division. White Americans had been divided over slavery for 50 years before the crisis that led to war in 1861. The Missouri Crisis of 1820, the Nullification Crisis of 1832, the conflict over the 1846 war with Mexico, and the Compromise of 1850 all reflect the degree to which American politics rested on a sectional divide over the future of the slave system. What made the 1850s different was the extent to which that division threatened the political economy of slavery. At the start of the decade, the historian Matthew Karp writes, in This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy, slaveholding power and slaveholding confidence seemed at their zenith, the result of spiking global demand for cotton and the dependence of the entire industrial world on a commodity that only American slaves could produce with profit. But with power came backlash. Over the course of the decade, Karp notes, slavery was prohibited in the Pacific states, came under attack in Kansas, and appeared unable to attach itself to any of the great open spaces of the New Southwest. The growth of an avowedly anti-slavery public in the North wasn't just a challenge to the political influence of the slaveholding South. It also threatened to undermine the slave economy itself, and thus the economic basis for Southern power. Plantation agriculture rapidly exhausted the soil. The sectional balance of Congress aside, planters needed new land to grow the cotton that secured their influence on the national and international stage. As Karp explains, slaveholders in the 1850s seldom passed up an opportunity to sketch the inexorable syllogism of King Cotton. The American South produced nearly all of the world's usable raw cotton. This cotton fueled the industrial development of the North Atlantic. Therefore, the advanced economies of France, the northern United States, and Great Britain were ruled in effect by southern planters. The backlash to slavery, the effort to restrain its growth and contain its spread, was an existential threat to the southern elite. It was the realization of that threat with the election of Abraham Lincoln, whose Republican Party was founded to stop the spread of slavery and who inherited a federal state with the power to do so, that pushed southern elites to gamble their future on secession. They would leave the Union and attempt to forge a slave empire on their own. The point of this compact history with regard to the present is that it is irresponsible to talk about civil war as a function of polarization or division or rival ideologies. If those things matter, and they do, it is in how they both reflect and shape the objective interests of the people and factions in dispute. Which is to say that if you're worried about a second civil war, the question to us isn't whether people hate each other. They always have, and we tend to grossly exaggerate the extent of this country's political and cultural unity over time. But whether that hate results from the irreconcilable social and economic interests of opposing groups within the society. If it must be one way or the other, then you might have a conflict on your hands. That's where America was with slavery. That's why our actual civil war has been called the impending crisis. I'm not sure there's anything in American society right now that plays the same role that the conflict over slavery did. Whatever our current challenges, whatever our current divisions, I do not think the United States is where it was in 1860. We have enough problems ahead of us already without having to worry about war breaking out here. IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the debate. I'm Kamit Awi. An empty shell. That is how Iran's top security official has described the JCPOA. Does this mean that the fate of the JCPOA revival talks is in danger? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the parties to the deal, the U.S. and its European partners, can give Iran the guarantees that it is looking for. We will also look at why Israel showed up at the Vienna talks and which party felt the need for it to be present there. Let's first get an update about the talks that are going on, the revival, JCPOA revival talks that are going on in Vienna. Of course, one of Homa Jaleski joins us from there. If we have Homa, can you please tell us what the latest is regarding the JCPOA revival talks?
Yes, Kaveh, we just had a tweet by the Russian lead delegate, Mikhail Ulyanov, and he said that consultations are continuing, intensive discussions almost non-stop, as of course we are reaching, as everyone is saying, the final stages of these negotiations. It looks like it's a make or break situation now. Earlier, the Chinese lead delegate also addressed reporters today, and he said In his words, this is the last stage of the talks and we are a step away from a final agreement. And he said that he's pleased to say that the sides are taking steps towards each other, of course, meaning the positions that have been expressed, saying that both Iran has come with constructive initiatives on the table following the political decisions that it's already made. And he said that the Europeans and the Americans have also come up with some efforts, and he believes that they are taking steps towards each other. And that the next 1 or 2 days, he said, are going to be quite crucial. We also had earlier, as we said, remarks by the French foreign minister addressed to the Senate, where he said that the onus is now on Iran, that Iran has to make the decision. At the same time, Iranian officials have made it clear that they have already come up with their initiatives. They have already taken the steps necessary. They're not going to go beyond the JCPOA. And now, if the United States particularly makes the decisions when it comes to guarantees on sanctions removal, verified sanctions removal, and the removal of all of the Trump-era sanctions, including entities and people, individuals who've been sanctioned under the Trump administration for various other reasons that are not directly JCPOA-related, then this is not going to work. And also guarantees the U.S. is not going to withdraw. And at this stage, however, all sides are still saying that a deal is within reach. We'll have to see if that is going to happen. Kaveh.
Indeed. Thank you so much for that. Homa Leski there from Vienna. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fouad Izzadi, university professor and political analyst, joins us from the capital, Tehran. Also joining us is Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. And Fouad Izzadi, let me first start with you and get an idea from you. Our reporter from Vienna, Homa Leski, used this American saying, make or break. So what do you think will make this work? What do you think will break it?
Well, the breaking part is easier to do. The United States is in the business of breaking things in general, bombing things and occupying places. And they can do that by continuing the failed policies of the Trump administration, as they have done in the last year since they have been in office. If they continue these maximum pressure tactics that Trump used, the talks are going to fail. That's one option they have. The other option they have is get rid of this addiction to sanctions. The sanctions are not going to cause the overthrow of the Iranian government. Sanctions are not going to cause Iranians to give more concessions to the other side. Sanctions are going to hurt ordinary Iranian citizens. And that's it, which is not a good thing to do. And what the United States needs to do is to decide whether they want to continue the failed policies of the past or realize previous mistakes and correct previous mistakes. If they lift sanctions, if they return to their commitments under JCPOA, then you can have an agreement. If they talk about a longer and a stronger document, if they want to change the text of JCPOA, if they want to find ways of going around their commitments, then the Iranian side is going to be more careful this time. There's this American saying that you fooled me once, shame on you. If you fooled me twice, shame on me. And the Iranians are not going to be fooled twice by the same group.
Indeed. Well, I'm at a loss of words for the third American saying, Daniel Lazar. But Daniel Lazar, you've been obviously following these JCPOA revival talks in Vienna for quite some time. And obviously you're familiar with the news, but we're really at what stage right now? What are we looking at? We're seeing right now in terms of perhaps Iran saying, listen, this ball is in your court. I know some of these statements, some of these stances may sound repetitive, but they're not, because there's been a lot of negotiations taking place. Where do you think we're at right now?
Well, it's very hard to tell because, you know, we're viewing things from the outside. And so we really have no idea what's actually going on inside the negotiating room. But I must say that I have been very skeptical from the very beginning about the success of these talks. And I still am. I think that the mood in the U.S. Makes a U.S. compromise all but impossible. Congress is adamant, extremely hostile to Iran. Nationalism is growing. America is in a very bellicose mood, especially since Afghanistan, the disastrous pullout in August, and even more since the Ukraine crisis. So America is in no mood to compromise, and so therefore I am very skeptical about any chance of these talks ending successfully.
Well, let's talk about the skepticism, but in another way, if we can, Fuad Izzati, and that's from the Iranian side, because if anything, they are the ones that need to not only maintain their skepticism because of what has happened before, but they need the guarantees. But are they going to get them? We're talking about the guarantees first and foremost, I think, for the U.S. next administration to adhere to this deal, let alone the ones that are needed in order for this to even work. What are we looking at from that vantage point of the Iranians on that?
Well, we are looking at Washington that's in chaos. We have the Republican Congress people that are totally opposed to any agreement with Iran. They like to continue the maximum pressure campaign. And then we have some Democrats like Robert Menendez, who is the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S. Senate. He talked about Iran for about an hour last week. And one of the demands that he made was that P5 plus one countries, he's asking them to use the snapback mechanism to bring back all sanctions against Iran. And he's a Democrat. He opposed JCPOA last time in 2015. We have Chuck Schumer, who also opposed JCPOA and did not vote for it. He is the majority leader in the U.S. Senate. He was not the majority leader in 2015. He is now. So you have opposition among Democrats inside the U.S. Congress. And if the U.S. returns to the agreement and has the capacity to use the snapback sanction, I don't think next time Robert Menendez will ask P5 plus one countries to use the snapback mechanism. He will pass a law to do that, and they may have enough vote to actually overcome a presidential veto if Biden decides to veto that. So there are a lot of complications in Washington. The United States is designed in that manner. And generally, when there is disagreement between the U.S. Congress and the administration, many times, generally, the U.S. Congress wins because of different reasons. So we have to be very careful with what Robert Malley, the U.S. representative in Vienna, is saying. Because we don't know if he's actually representing the United States government as an entity. The U.S. government is divided on these issues, even within the Biden administration. You had people like Richard's nephew leaving the negotiating team because of what he said, disagreements with the direction. So there's a lot of complications, and that leads the Iranian negotiating team to be much more cautious when it comes to believing what the U.S. side is saying.
And that's exactly what Iran has said. I'm sorry about that, Fuhrerzade. I thought you were done. I apologize. But to follow that train of thought, Daniel Lazar, Iran has said that there's divisions within the U.S. And, of course, as Fuhrerzade said there, the two lawmakers there, Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez, and, of course, you had the 34 lawmakers led by Senator Ted Cruz. Who is it that's making – well, let me say it this way. Is the team in Vienna that's talking indirectly with Iran representative of what will happen, or is the one in Washington and the lawmakers there the ones that are going to decide, or is there a split?
Well, both sides. I mean, the negotiators in Vienna are there in behalf of the executive branch, the presidency, and the lawmakers are part of the legislative branch, obviously. But the lawmakers, though, do have the power to block any kind of agreement. But also, more importantly, you have to bear in mind that the anti-Iran sentiment, pro-Israeli sentiment is very, very strong in the U.S. The Democrats, for example, are no better than the Republicans in this regard. In fact, in some ways, they actually may be worse. So I just don't see any kind of political support for a successful conclusion to these negotiations. I think that any attempt by the Biden administration to compromise, to eliminate sanctions, would lead to a storm of opposition in Washington. I don't think that it would survive that reaction. So I think I'm just, as I said before, to reiterate, I am extremely pessimistic regarding these talks.
Fuhrerzade, we know that the voice of Israel on this, which many consider noise, has been going on for quite some time, but it was somewhat of a shock in a sense, and I'd like to find out from you what you thought when the news came out that there were Israeli diplomats that were in Vienna on the sidelines of these JCPOA revival talks. An Israeli delegation, some called it. I'm curious as to, what you think of it, but whether they were invited or they just decided to hop on a plane and go to Vienna. What did you think of that?
You know, I think we are getting near the talks. I don't think the talks will continue much longer. And it's a decision time for the other side to decide what to do. And obviously, the Israelis want to influence that decision. That's why they flew to Vienna. They have been flying to Washington also, and they have been lobbying with other members of P5+1 to actually get what they want, which is causing more difficulties for people in Iran. And
what do you think? If I may jump in there, why do you think they chose to meet with Rafael Grossi and Russia's representative? Why those two?
Well, they need to talk to Mr. Grossi because they want to use the International Atomic Energy Agency to put pressure on Iran. And Russians have been helpful in the last number of months, and they want to reduce the effectiveness of the Russian delegation in actually helping other parties to reach an agreement. So they realize that Russians have been influential, and they want to also cause difficulty with that. And we have Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, that is visiting Israel today and fully supporting anti-Iran policies of Israel, and stating again that they're going to be in one front against Iran. Mm. So when we see that, when we see the latest resolution by Bob Menendez and Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, about the idea of Iran not enriching any uranium inside the country, and then they say that even if Iran accepts that, they want to continue sanctions on Iran for other reasons. And they also, in that resolution, call for the U.S. Congress to approve whatever agreement the executive branch of the United States makes in Vienna. So we have all these data points that make people in Tehran much more cautious with regard to what the other side is actually doing.
I've never understood, maybe Daniel Lazar, you can enlighten us as to why Israel really is so much against this. I mean, we know some of the reasons, obviously, but when you take a look at what this JCPOA revival talks will do, in essence, it is something that obviously Iran will fall in line with what the JCPOA was. And Israel should be somewhat satisfied about that, but yet it has gone out of its way, obviously, to try to derail the talks, for lack of a better word. My question to you here is that this delegation was an Israeli foreign ministry official, and you also had the Israeli regime's envoy to the IAEA there. How can he be telling the IAEA, when Israel has nuclear warheads and is not an NPT member, of what to do here?
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. It's quite arrogant. You're quite right. But Israel's attitude towards Iran is one of maximum hostility. Israel sees Iran as its chief enemy in the Middle East, and therefore it wants to do whatever it can to hurt, harm, retard, isolate the Iranian state. And therefore, it uses all its influence in Washington to persuade the U.S. to do the same. And Israel has been very effective, but America is very hostile to Iran on its own account. Listen, Americans don't know anything about Iran, nothing at all. They can barely find it on the map. But one thing every American knows is the 1979-80 embassy takeover. I guarantee you of that. Those memories are still fresh. They will be fresh for years to come. And that is ultimately the source of the great hostility in the U.S. towards Iran.
Well, I'm guessing, Fouad Azadi, that one thing that Americans also can't forget, especially the Treasury Department, is how ineffective the sanctions have been. And I'm going to come in here with a tweet of which Ali Shamkhani said, the Supreme National Security Council director, "It is not possible to promise to lift the sanction that has become ineffective in order to score a point." So I'm sure the American side knows that. Why are they continuing with their sanction regime?
Well, they don't know any other thing. It seems that U.S. foreign policy is just sanctions and sanctions and sanctions, even when they don't achieve foreign policy goals. The U.S. Foreign policy has become one-dimensional, creating hostility and then sanctioning the other side. That's the basic formula. And the difficulty that exists is that when you continue this sanctions policy, sooner or later that policy will fail, as Mr. Shamkhani mentioned today, that Iran selling a lot of oil as we speak and getting the money back. So the other side promising lifting of sanctions when the sanctions have become ineffective is not going to be very attractive, given the fact that the other side in Washington is clueless with regard to what they want to do with their Iran policy and all the disagreements that they have. Another important piece of news today, I think, was Iran's foreign minister interview with the Financial Times, requiring the U.S. Congress to have a vote on the nuclear talks. I think that's very important. Before Iran reaches an agreement, we need to know what the U.S. Congress thinks about the agreement, because we realize that they have the power to influence the direction that the U.S. executive branch takes. And if the U.S. Congress is represented by people like Bob Menendez or Lindsey Graham, then we realize that whatever Robert Malley tells Iranian delegation in Vienna is not really going to be implemented. And last time, the U.S. stayed in the nuclear agreement for about 2.5 years. This time, given what we have been talking about, I'm not sure if they managed to stay in the nuclear agreement for 2.5 months. And that's the cause of concern, and that's why you see Iranian officials are becoming quite doubtful about the value of the nuclear agreement.
Well, one of the things that has resulted, Daniel Lazar, over the course of time that's been expanding is the scope of Iran's gravitation towards the East. And in particular, we could talk about, obviously, number one, China, and then Russia along with that. The trade bloc, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, another example where Iran joined, and just the expansion of these trade relations, which brings about this sanctions-proof shield for Iran, making sanctions ineffective. The U.S. realizes that, I am sure. So therefore, shouldn't that be a factor in the decision-making for the U.S.?
Well, it should be a factor, of course, but it's not. I mean, America is in a very bad situation. From 1989 until 2001, or even later, it was the great unipolar moment for America. America ruled the world. Its word was law. Its power was overwhelming. And really, it was in a position that no other imperial power had ever attained before. And now politicians are desperate to get back to the to somehow recapture that golden moment. And that is Biden's mission. Biden's slogan is America is back, and that he wants to turn the clock back to that golden age. Whereas it would make sense for the U.S. to compromise with Iran, if only to sort of calm down one theater of operations.
Sure. I got to unfortunately jump in, and I'm sorry about that. Gifuat Azadi, just 30 seconds that we have left in time. Gifuat Azadi, in closing, your statements, please.
You know, I think your other guest in New York was getting to the right point that he was making. I think he was making a very important statement that President Biden is not Obama and John Kerry is not around. We have Tony Blinken. And people make a difference. And the goal of the current administration is something different from what we saw before, and you're going to see the result that's going to be different.
Thank you very much for that. I do apologize for cutting you off there, Daniel Lazar. Unfortunately, again, we're fresh out of time. Fuad Azadi there, university professor and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. Daniel Lazar, pleasure, journalist and author from New York.